Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. You know, we know about our coal severance trust fund. It's been around for, well, I guess I couldn't even tell you how many years, 50, maybe more. It's done some good things for us here, too. There's a new trust fund in our government. It's called the Growth and Opportunity Trust Fund, right? It's not quite $1 billion, nearly $1 billion. How does it work? What does it pay for? Are trust funds a good idea? Today, we're going to talk with veteran lawmaker, main sponsor of this bill, House Bill 924, State Representative Lou Jones. It's really a landmark piece of legislation, kick-starting with $900 million, $600 million the upcoming, and then they'll have $300 million into that, too. I looked at some debate on this. You know, there are those who feel flexibility is lost here a little bit. The use of surplus funds, is that right? But there are those who will look at this, too, and say housing, child care, infrastructure. This is a long-term financial move. We're going to get into it today and understand it with Representative Lou Jones on Voices of Montana. Today, we're going to learn about this Growth and Opportunity Trust Fund. And I know, as I mentioned, you don't get anything across the line without really engaging with the people who might oppose this piece of legislation and try to address some of those concerns. And that's really the process of governance. We'll look at this new trust fund with one of the main authors there. And really, as we say, a veteran of our Montana legislature, 20 plus years now, it's State Representative Lou Jones. Representative Jones serves House District 18. He's from Conrad, but that's also Shelby and Villiers, good country up there. How you doing, Lou?
Doing well, sir. Doing well.
Thank you for joining us. I appreciate this. You got this one over the finish line. And I got to imagine that felt pretty good for you. As I looked at this, you know, I might have had some reservations that it grows government. Let's talk about this, because trust funds have become a way, well, in my mind, to simplify it, you're getting the banks, so to speak, to pay for ongoing government services, but you first have to have that trust fund. It's a pretty large dollar amount.
Well, yeah, trusts aren't new. So, you know, you got to start at the beginning here, which is when we came to town on the legislature, there's always pressures, and we knew we wanted to do permanent tax cuts, right? And we did about $1 billion, income tax, permanent property tax, some rebates coming up. There's debate going on that, but obviously the tax notices coming out seem to be showing that taxable value in areas like Billings across the state are down despite market values being up. So that worked. We also knew we had to spend some money. We had a public safety problem. Again, Yellowstone's an example of that, but across the state. So we had to spend some, and we did on additional public safety, prisons, build out, set some money aside for that, fire, the high risk stuff. You know, we took care of that. We knew we had to spend some on getting our schools caught up. Our teacher pay was low. We weren't getting dual credit and career tech ed, so we spent some on some of those areas. We put some in reserves. Thankfully, we did that because we're linked to the federal tax cuts, the big, beautiful bill, which is doing good things, but it'll impact our income. Mm-hmm. And finally, we made a decision on some of the volatile revenue to create a trust fund, the Growth and Opportunity Trust, which, as it's currently set up, and it would take a law to change that, right? You'd have to change law. It puts money towards bridges, water infrastructure, housing, childcare, and it takes care of our unfunded pension liability. And so we began with the thought we wanted to cut some taxes, we wanted to fund some priorities, we wanted to save some smart money, and we wanted to invest wisely. And so that was the beginning of the concept of the trust fund, which I wrote for before he wrote and supported, even before the session started. So that was the thought of how it began. It was modeled after successful trusts in Alaska, North Dakota, New Mexico has one, Wyoming, although theirs is enormous. But we thought we have to look at where we're at, and some of this volatile income that's linked to capital gains that comes and goes, some of this money we can't do permanent things with. We could make a choice to invest in our future. And so yeah, it starts at about $600 million, grows to $1 billion over the next 4 years or so, assuming, you know, the volatile revenue is there, and starts changing this volatile money into funding for, I'll just pick on bridges, because all the county commissioners, for instance, across the state came in and said, you have to help with our $2 billion local bridge infrastructure problem. We don't want to keep raising your property taxes to pay for these local bridges. So a portion of this money goes towards an 80-20 match. The county still have to put up 20 to take care of the bridges, which is the heartbeat of the economy in these local towns. Same conversation on water. Right, we're a headwater state, whether it's for recreation, whether it's for drinking, whether it's for agriculture. We've got a bunch of dams. We've got waterways. How do we match local investment and keep this water that is so critical to Montana, no matter what industry you're in, or into your home, and a nice, cool drink of water is a good thing, viable? And, of course, the chamber has prioritized child care, right? They're doing it from the workforce side. If you can't have, we have a workforce shortage, and so they prioritize some of the build out of some of these affordable child care areas so that we can ensure that folks can have children if they wish and know that there's some child care available that's a quality child care where they can go to work and continue to be part of the Montana workforce. So that became a part of it. Housing, obviously, we've done some great work on some of the challenges of housing, but there is still a need to build out the underlying infrastructure so we can have affordable housing in a state where the housing is simply exploding. You know, so again, that became something that the interest in this trust fund could support. You know, and finally, right, built into this trust fund is when it gets big enough, it begins to give property tax rebates. Ongoing property tax rebates. So, yeah, we invested some, and I would consider that we invested it wisely.
Well, you had a lot of things on your plate, as you noted. Public safety, tax relief, education, infrastructure, child care, housing, pension. You know, and as I looked at this, I had to learn about what volatile funds were and was wondering, it makes sense now to me, but was wondering why you pick volatile funds to create a pension fund with, but it makes sense now. I'll have you talk about that. Well, I think it's unique in some ways is that it does use volatile state revenue, where all these other states, Wyoming, Alaska, North Dakota, they've got some kind of oil and gas revenue or natural resource revenue tied into this. What kind of haul was this for the supporters?
It took some work, right? For the same reason you just mentioned is, folks take a look at money that happens to be in the account in a given year, and they assume it's going to be there every year, and you can just permanently cut it. But I'll pick on capital gains. We have got capital gains from $3 billion in the state to $9 billion, and then back down again, right? So we can't assume the income taxes related with capital gains of that volatile portion are going to be there every year. So basically what we looked at is that we take one-third of the volatility when it's there, we direct it to this trust. We're changing that volatile funding into a permanent flow. Interest rates, short-term interest rates are another. You know, I've seen the short-term interest rate, the TCA rate, at 0.25% and at 5%. But we can't do permanent stuff, assume it's always going to be at 5%. It would seem like our short-term rate would go back down. And so we are taking these volatile funds, and we did a proof of concept. I think I sent it to you. We didn't just use state analysis. We used Pew, which does nonpartisan group, which does significant analysis on what worked. And in truth, I took about 35% of volatile funds and directed them here. And they said, well, the only thing you should have done better is you should have took 50%. Well, 35% was hard to do. So maybe that's a future argument. It was difficult to be able to move that amount of money over into here. And now they're actually approaching other states and saying, if you're an income tax-based state like Montana, you should consider this as the basis for your trust fund. We have a coal trust, as my friend Dwayne Ankeny used to say. There's a little coal dust and a whole lot of projects across Montana. Hopefully in the future, this will be a partner with the coal trust and become, you know, something akin to it. Again, other states are finding what their revenues are, doing the same thing. This was our potential stream that we could convert volatile revenue into ongoing funding that would offset projects that would otherwise cost increases in local property tax.
What are the guardrails? What are the guardrails that are going to keep it just, you know, a fund that's used for the right reasons and not become a political tool down the road? I mean, that's one of my concerns, and I expressed them with you too, and was that I worry that this grows government in the wrong way. And I know there's a place for government. I mean, there's no arguing that. But I was concerned that you're creating pots of funding that could be raided in the future, so to speak, and it just grows government and doesn't shrink government. Talk about that. Talk about the dynamic of putting guardrails on this.
Well, this does require, the way this was written, it would require a 2/3 vote of the legislature, because even the coal trust can be raided, yes. Right? It would require a 2/3 vote in order to be able to change and appropriate that, and because we can't completely bind a future legislature,
right? Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
We are just like the previous legislatures can't bind us. So there is always a risk if the right group of folks is elected, they could come in and say we don't want to put money towards local bridges again, and if they can get the right vote, I guess that could happen. You know. There is no guarantee other than it does take a supermajority vote, right? And obviously, each one of these, I imagine if you came in and you said, we're going to take all the money, I'll pick on bridges again, out of the local bridge section, you'd have every county commissioner up in arms screaming, what are you doing? What are you doing? Right? It's without a doubt, the coal trust has evolved greatly over the last 20 years, and I'm aware of that because I evolved it a lot. For instance, it didn't used to have a school maintenance section. It now does. So with the right vote, you can evolve stuff, but usually you have to have an argument of why what you're evolving it to is better than what it was. And again, if we go to the coal trust, we put those school maintenance section in there. It's got about $275 million now whose interest goes to school maintenance in the coal trust. It was so that local property taxpayers didn't have to come up with all the money to do school maintenance. There was a matching fund out. So in the end, it could evolve. It likely will evolve. But it can't just be raided. It has to be, you'd have to change the appropriation. The exec can't change it without the legislature. The legislature can't change it without a vote. And obviously, those are public things. People are going to show up and say, what are you doing? Or there's enough money in that section. Maybe we should move some.
Does it grow government, in my mind, in the wrong way?
Well, I don't see how, right? I don't see how fixing local bridges gross government, because we're either going to fix them with a state partnership or the local folks are going to have to take care of it. I don't see how, to me, it was an investment in the underlying structure of government, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at or the economy, I've always looked back at the past, and I'm really glad that our forefathers invested in things like Hungry Horse Dam and the roads, because that's the basis for the business I run and pay taxes from. Right, so I don't think a private entity is probably fixing a dam. I don't think a private entity is probably doing bridges, right? I when you looked at these sections, you know, the underlying foundation, the water, the sewer, the road, the sidewalk, to building out additional housing, right now the Coal Trust, via its TCEP, does some of that, but this also partners in some of this. Right, because obviously we fell behind on housing supply, or we wouldn't have the most exploding housing prices in the country, at least in some portions of the state. You know, we are seen as the state with some of the largest, they call them child care deserts. There's just not child care facilities available. So it's hard for a working mother then to, with a two-year-old, what are you going to do if you could probably go to work, but you're going to have, you know, what is it, 10 children are tend to be taken care of by one child care worker. That means 10 folks can go to work.
Mm-hmm.
So all these arguments came to us either from the business side, from the commissioner side, you know, and the pension portion in here. Every time you go to Helner, you hear about this unfunded liability on pensions. Well, this, again, backs off so we don't have a crash one day that gets dumped on the taxpayers of that day. So I saw this as an investment in the future. I guess the argument could be made that, well, local governments just have to find a way to fix those bridges, and the local members of that community just need to pay the taxes to fix them.
Yeah, and that's not going to get you anywhere, though, either. I mean, that argument, the math doesn't work for that argument because of the high cost of bridges. And Growth and Opportunity Trust Fund, now signed into law by Governor Greg Gianforte. And I'd asked him about that a while ago, too. Are you looking, you know, what do you think about that one? Because I thought he would have some concerns about it, too. He didn't answer that question specifically. We'll take a look at everything. But I guess in my mind, I was curious as to how he would view this. The main sponsor of this bill is Representative Lou Jones. Conrad, veteran lawmaker, House District 18, serves Shelby and Valier all the way to the Canadian border there as well. And it really, it's a permanent now state fund that's designed to redirect this volatile revenue, which is like capital gains or some of those fluctuations in income tax. The COVID relief money would be considered volatile revenue to seed this fund. And from there, there are directed spending. Representative Jones, I appreciate you being here on this one. Let's look at, again, some of these guardrails or you know, maybe more of the nuts and bolts of this. You carved out some specific funding priorities here as well. How does the fund build? You're seeding it, but you're also going to take some of the interest and reseed back into that fund. And I guess as an example, I read that North Dakota's legacy fund started out that way, and now it's near $10 billion as they have taken care of their fund as well. Get more into it, if you would, for us. Thanks.
Sure. So, well, obviously, the fund generates interest, right? And portions of the fund could potentially be invested because of the way it's laid out, the pension portion of some of them can be invested in some stocks and such that have kept our that earn a higher rate of return. So one, you have the interest rate recycle that comes along. But also, in any given year, what happens is the fund takes a look at over a 7-year period. It says it measures the highest, let's just use capital gains, but on those volatile sources, what's the capital gains, the max that was created, picked up, say it was $9 billion in the current example. What's the lowest? $3 billion. And those are the amounts the tax was applied to. And it says, well, this is the tax that came from the difference, the volatile portion, because it went 3 to 9 to 4. And it says we're going to take about 35% of that, and we're going to store it in the trust. Now, there are safeguards. Say, for example, we had a severe recession. That valve will turn off and it'll wait out. It leaves the money then in the general fund to be spent. But it looks at those volatile sources, and it takes and takes about a third of the volatility, and it drops that into the trust. Depending on the average year, that'll feed the trust about $100 million of additional corpus, right, that will begin to earn interest on it. Some years it's 120, it can be 70, and there could be a year when it was zero. But over time, that continual inflow combined with some of the interest it gathers grows this trust, you know. And, of course, then a percentage of it goes towards the bridges. It goes towards the water, et cetera. So it's set up in a manner that's somewhat similar to the coal trust. The coal trust is harvesting income off of the sale of coal, which, of course, we're having some struggles with. This is harvesting a portion of the income tax dollars that are volatile and just storing this away. So it's converting that volatile revenue into kind of a permanent interest payment on those areas that were deemed critical. And of course, you brought up before, right now it takes a 2/3 vote to change this around. But certainly in time, someone could say, well, we don't have a child care issue anymore. We've taken care of the bridges. That would be shocking to me.
Right.
But it certainly could happen. And they could say we need a new leg, or we need to put additional funding into a different leg. We also created, as one of the drops, where 20% of the interest goes, a property tax relief rebate. So it'll take a while for that to get big. Once that hits $50 million, it dumps and everybody gets a property tax rebate.
Oh, okay.
Because we wanted to also not only take care of ongoing needs, but to make sure that the taxpayer, if this fund gets big enough and it becomes, you use North Dakota, $10 billion fund, that's a substantial property tax rebate every year. You know, so it's designed to try to meet those things that we could foresee today and be proactive instead of reactive in these areas.
It's an interesting model, and you know, to pay for some of these government services, taking volatile funds and making them more stable for this purpose. As I noted, I see some of these other models out there, and I don't know, is this tried anywhere else in terms of using this kind of funding for a trust fund?
No, this is a, there's lots of trust funds out there. This is a new model, and as I shared with you, and I think I sent you the Pew letter, just went to some meetings with them, they are enamored with this concept and saying this is, because a lot of their states don't have natural resource bases to build trust funds, they're seeing this as a potential way for states that don't have substantial natural resources to build trust funds. Obviously, we have a coal trust, but this, as we're evolving to be, especially the western 60%, so we are some of a more of an income tax ping on a lot of areas, this gives us a two bites at the apple, per se.
What did the governor think about it? I mean, as I expressed earlier, kind of knowing Greg a little bit, I think he likes when things are paid for, but I would see having some reservations about this as well. But he signed it into law. What was that conversation like with you guys?
We had a number of conversations. You got to remember that the governor proposed a series of mini trusts. He had a bridge trust fund. He had our bridge funding bill. He had a water, you know, that when Tostin Dam's generator went down, he had a water section. He had a pension section very much like the ones that are in this bill. So what we did is we reached out and touched every one of those sections he was proposing. And there was ones he was not, right? He was not proposing a child care one. That came from the chamber side. You know, and we combined them into one spot, because as a person that's been looking at the finances a long time, it's far easier to go to one spot and look at what's happening than try to run down a whole bunch of little pots. If I had to pick, you asked what grows government. Mm-hmm. If I had to pick what grows government, it's a bunch of hidden little pots that you lose track of. You have a billion-dollar fund somewhere like the coal trust or what this could potentially be. You're going to look at it every time.
I'm going to kind of move off of this a little bit. Well, we will after the break, too. I only got like 45 seconds here, too. I'm going to be curious as to watch this fund build, watch how it's used as well, and hopefully it is a really good model for us. You probably can't answer this even in 10 seconds, but we'll get to the housing. Do you have I'm not even going to ask you for a yes or no on this one. We'll just take this break upcoming, and then we'll talk about the housing solution and, you know, do we need to move forward with other activity on that as well. Part of the Montana legislature for a number of years, still active in his family's ranch as well in the Conrad area. Him and Carol have been a fixture in Conrad for a number of years, 4 kids there. And we're talking about Representative Lou Jones, who started his career as an alderman in Conrad. And now, Representative Jones, did you imagine that you were going to have a 20-year career in Montana legislature when you kind of got started?
No, I kind of got hijacked into running and handy with numbers, you know, master's degree in econometrics.
Right. Yeah, MSU, by the
really
way.
Plan on being a props and kind of got dropped into that section and been a props and finance and claims for a long, long time. But to me, I try to let the data drive the thought instead of the soundbite.
Yeah, I like that. And we've had over the years, you know, soundbite wars, so to speak, in our media. And I don't appreciate that. You know, I just want straight data. We can make good decisions if we have good data in that regard. But politics has gotten real messy. Well, in fact, we'll get back into some of the policies here, but there's this chasm that's been developing, you know, the Solutions Caucus, the Montana Freedom Caucus in the Republican Party. It's at times, and it's not just this year, but at times these two interests have gone at each other, so to speak, and probably during this as well, because they're, you know, the Freedom Caucus very much more fiscally conservative, kind of everything they play a little bit close to the vest. Maybe talk about where that's at right now, Representative, and just a quick comment, because I don't see a lot of them around, but I'm still seeing some ads, and I know there's robocalls out there about this last session.
Yeah, well, first off, I kind of reject the concept that the fiscal cost, the Freedom Caucus, is more fiscally conservative.
Okay, yeah.
Because this argument that if you just slash and burn everything, you know, if you don't fix your roof and you don't fix your water and you don't fix your sewer, you certainly save some money today. What you visit upon your children and your grandchildren in the future sure as heck isn't fiscally conservative. It's, to me, it's fiscal imprudence. We have a challenge, right? You live in a two-year election cycle, right? So politics is reactive. Everybody's trying to find out, it would have been easier for me, rather than do this trust, and just to give a big rebate and run all over the state patting myself on the back for a rebate. Great short-term decision, not so good for the kids' bridges in the future or our water systems long-term, and then be shocked when they fail and decry that government did a bad job. But ultimately, my whole goal since I've been there is try to move from reactive to proactive. It's what I've always practiced in the businesses we do. So proactive means you think about the future. It means that you keep some money in savings to take care of that rainy day. If we had not did reserves, the big, beautiful bill changes that are coming along would be definitely forcing a special session. But we are reserved fairly well. We have a coal trust. Now we have a growth and opportunity. All of those are investments in providing funding to keep the underlying infrastructure of this state and this business alive and well. Same with education. If you don't take care of education, you don't educate your future students so that they are ready for the economy, it's going to turn out bad for you, even if you save some money today. So, there's certainly a divide. I hear the voices out there that this trust fund is a slush fund for Lou Jones and his cronies. I'm not sure how exactly fixing a bridge is a slush fund for Lou Jones, but whatever. I get that's how the soundbite system works. You know, I know there's arguments about vetting. You need to vet candidates. Some party boss somewhere should get to decide if you're a real Republican or what, based upon their definition of a Republican or the word conservative. But I always thought that should be the voter's choice. If we return to thinking about we want to retain our liberties, I would say fiscal responsibility, so we do that right. And obviously I wanted the smallest parcel. We respect local control, and then we respect the voter's choice. The voters get to decide who represents them, not some party boss in a back room. You know, I found it extremely disrespectful to, well, it was nine people, it's about 190,000 voters, that their folks couldn't vote at this GOP election. To me, that it certainly made great headlines, and we argued they didn't vote with the platform or the Freedom Caucus did. Now, of course, you have the Trump platform, that Republican platform, drastically different than the Montana one, so I don't know which one they were supposed to swear allegiance to. But this sort of reactive nature and soundbite politics that are brought to us by both tails, to be honest, the extreme right and extreme left, I don't see this as a positive path for Montana, at least. I'm pleased that at least up to this date, Montana balances its budget, and so far we've been able to make pretty decent long-term decisions. You know, Gianforte's done a pretty good job. Now, of course, I get along with him well. I think he manages quite well. But to my Freedom Caucus friends, he's no longer a conservative. Well, I guess maybe he's thinking that fiscal responsibility means you look up and think about the future. You know, I always tell people, you got to put blades in the snowplow, and you got to pay for some fuel and a driver. It doesn't really matter if it's parked somewhere.
I'll just throw in, though, I mean, I understand that, you know, when people talk about bipartisanship, why does it always seem to be, from their standpoint, all right, and I don't know if I want to get into it a ton here, it's a hard fight to reduce spending in this government. And I think the main concern is how government has grown, how it's got authority in every aspect of our lives, and pulling that back, as you can see with the Trump administration, they've done. You're going to create a lot of waves in that regard, but I think that's necessary. I think it's a good thing, and the thing is, it seems like the media just paints everybody who's trying to right-size government as a heartless, cruel person cutting necessary services. We have gotten super big and super large, and I don't like the direction it's going. So I appreciate that standpoint. I know you do too. That's part of the whole political process.
I want to deliver services as affordably as possible. But again, if you take Montana's growth rate relative to everywhere in this country, we're seen as one of the most conservative states because we have controlled at the state level for certain, because I can just give you the math problem, right? I can show the charts. We can put the growth on a chart, and you can plot them from year to year to year, and they are what they are. Right now we can make up numbers, we can say stuff, but the chart is what the chart is. Can we do better? Better is always possible, mm-hmm. Right? But when we define what we're going to cut, and there's two different statements here, right? Obviously, on the fiscal side, we need to be as fiscally prudent as we can be. I very much do not like the growth into people's, you know, I always tell people, leave my checkbook alone,
right.
Stay out of my checkbook, stay out of my bedroom, stay out of my life. And but that's where government seems to grow. It has a new rule for everything. And I do think we're making some headway here and at the federal level, yeah. Albeit that the new big, beautiful bill is a big spender, too. It'll be interesting to see where that shakes out, right, because you don't know where it lands on the Laffer curve.
Right.
I'm supportive of it because it's good for the Montana taxpayer. It's good for... certainly good for a bunch of our businesses. But in the end, I don't want to go out there in the wintertime and have no snow plows or have no schools. And it would really be bad to dial 911 and have nobody show up.
It is a concern. And there's a lot I like about that. And some people who have reservations, they're justified to it. We'll walk it out. Representative Lou Jones with us. I got just about 3 or 4 minutes here, and I want to go back. You know, not that it's a special day, but this is my, like, I've been doing this show now for 6 years, yesterday or today. I can't remember when I first started, but it was in July. One of the first shows, you and I had a conversation about our tax structure in Montana. And it woke me up to about, as you described it, you know, it's three-legged now, and that resource leg is faltering a little bit. That's why we see more reliance on income tax and housing. And that, you know, got me thinking a lot about, okay, if we're going to change our tax structure in Montana, how does that happen? It takes a lot of guts to do it, and a process as well. Do we still need, I think we do. What are your thoughts on that? Do we still need to have that conversation about our overall tax structure in Montana? And if it does need to change, how does that happen?
So, yeah, we need to continue to hold the conversation, right? We have some amazing numbers. We have 12.5 tourists for every single Montana. 23% of all the taxable value of residential in Montana is mailed to an out-of-state address. Now, a lot of that we try to address in our property tax bill so that these out-of-state homeowners that aren't paying income tax here, that are not paying for like the fire fund and a bunch of the other services, are brought to the table, right? Because otherwise Montanans are covering for them. But it's a difficult conversation, right? If you, the word sales tax is painful to bring up. It's certainly not supported statewide. The governor said he would not sign it into law.
Mm-hmm.
But as we evolve, when I first got there, you had your natural resource leg be a much larger leg. It continues to be less relative to the overall economy. Now, I'd like to see natural resources grow again.
It can.
But
yeah.
I hope it can, but we're selling coal to the West Coast. We got to get them to buy it. We can't force people to buy it. I think it's a great energy, and it should. We need to grow that, right? Oil and gas, you know, we are a litigious state. So yeah, we have to focus on, folks come in and say, we want to have a tax cut. They received an income tax cut. I believe they will be pleasantly surprised come fall with what happens with residential and some of the property tax, small business property tax. But at the end of the day, you're going to have enough money on hand so that there's clean water in your tap and your toilet's flushed and an ambulance shows up and you have a firehouse. So you're trying to find that balance. And currently in Montana, it's landing really hard on the property taxpayer. It lands on the income taxpayer, not as visible because it's taken out, but we are an evolving state with a tax structure that was built for the day when natural resources owned the state. Mm. Hopefully we can grow natural resources. The Trump crew is much more focused that way. But 4 years is also a short time. We'll see what changes. And if you know, I've always been supportive of a natural resource economy. I grew up in an oil field, so I've always been good with it. But I also live in a world where if you're in the western part of the state, you see a whole lot of tourists, and a whole lot of us are paying for the toilets to flush.
And when will you know? And this is I've only got like about a minute left here too, because I need to get you out of here too. When will you know that the income, or pardon me, that housing tax solution, that tax relief solution? When will you know whether it's going to work or what you will need to do to make it better?
Yes. Well, the proof's always in the pudding when the final tax bills come out. What I can see now is the market value change, and I can see that taxable values across Montana have dropped per the DOR's numbers they just sent out. So I know on those two pieces it looks good. What I don't know is what local government's going to do with their mills. Mm. Right, because where the exec controls the reappraisal, the legislature controls the rate, local government controls the number of mills within reason. Mm-hmm. No matter what happens, residential will be far better off than it was. The final extent will require the next portion to come in, which is what local governments is going to mill, which is probably another month out, a little more. You know, we can see the taxable value drop. It's substantial. You know, I think in Yellowstone, taxable value is down. I wrote it here somewhere. I think it was down probably, it is. If taxable value dropped 24%. So residential taxable value, market value went up 15% in the Yellowstone. Taxable value dropped 24%. So we'll see what happens with the mills, because if the mills go up 30%, it's going to override the taxable value drop.
Yep.
I think we'll be better off. They were certainly a heck of a lot better off than if it didn't happen at all.
Lou, I appreciate the conversation. I really do. And you're a public servant, and I very much appreciate that too. Of course, I'm in the appreciation business. It's a tough job, and not everybody can do it. And even those who you might find in opposition, lots of just mad respect for what you guys do. So I look forward to chatting with you down the road too, okay?
Anytime, sir. You have a great day.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Say hello to Carol. And you getting rain over there?
No, well, we did early on, but she's a little hot and dry now. It rained in my area just enough to keep the crops going a little bit. Won't be a great harvest, but at least there's some crop out there. The pasture really sucks.
I can only hope and pray more. The more it comes, yeah.
That would be good.
Good stuff, Lou. Thank you so much. All right, have a great summer, sir.
You too.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast. And join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.